Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of our other episodes at cinematica.co.nz.
When you wish upon a star, make no difference who you are.
Oh, there it is.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the new look Star Wars theme tune now that Lucasfilm has been bought by Disney.
Wow. I was panicking. I go away for 2 weeks and it's a different intro. I was like, what's going on? Is it another podcast? Am I going to talk economics or something? Yes. But no, it's good.
No, we're trying to. When I was thinking this afternoon, as the news was running, you know, the news wires were running red hot with this news about Lucasfilm and Disney, I was thinking, what's that going to be like? You know, because Star Wars, for lots of people, is about the 20th Century Fox fanfare and then the theme tune. So thanks to Carter Nixon, he put that idea into my head via Twitter that it was going to be When You Wish Upon a Star.
So what's the drill? Is this, when's it coming out? What?
Okay, so here's the news, right?
I've been out of the loop for a little bit.
Alright, so here's what's happening. My understanding is that Lucasfilm for $4 billion has been sold to Walt Disney, so that makes it worth, as somebody pointed out, four times Instagram. And apparently Disney have already announced that there will be a Star Wars 7 in 2015. And I'm not sure whether that's a prequel or some kind of sequel or another
like
film.
Space Jam, where they drop in like Mickey Mouse. And
as long as they bring back, what is it, Jar Jar Jinx?
Jar Jar Binks.
Jar Jar Jinx, yeah.
You've got to have him in the mix. It'll work a treat then.
This is the thing.
Holograms of Ewan McGregor.
Well, it's a shame that you've had your head down working all day,
head
Simon,
down,
because this is the movie news of the day.
I know. It's pretty cool, isn't it? I must say, that's exciting. I'm excited, even though I just hope they do a kind of bond on it and they kind of take it back a bit and not be silly.
That's exactly the phrase that people are using, and that now that it's out of Lucas's clutches, as it were, basically they can just run the franchise in whatever way they see fit. They can reboot. Somebody was suggesting today that that rather than a sequel, they should just go back and make Star Wars 1 again, but with new people and better effects, make it a better film. You know, that would be a start. So all sorts of interesting possibilities. That was, in fact, the first item of the news. So when we come to it, just remember not to read that item.
Okay.
Yep. I'll just read it again. It's okay.
All right. Welcome to season 3, episode 3.
Hold on. Disney are doing that. I mean, how did they recover from
John Carter?
I mean, cash wise, they must. What's going on with Disney? They just got.
See, that's what I'm thinking. Is like a new Star Wars. John
pots
Carter.
Of cash, you know.
Yeah, but in other studio news today, I read that Sony are cutting back on staff and production costs and marketing costs, even though they made $400+ million from Men in Black 3. But their other films this year have not been doing the business. And actually, Sony own Bond, and Bond is going to do the business for them, surely.
Bond's going to do it, yeah.
So, yeah, who knows what that's all about, but definitely some austerity measures at Sony and Disney splunking the cash big time for the biggest franchise in the history of movies.
Because they've got the Marvel lineup too now, haven't they?
They do. And other people have been suggesting, wouldn't it be great to get Joss Whedon on board to reboot the Star Wars universe? Does he have some time left over?
Maybe. Did you see his Romney ad? It's amazing.
I didn't see that.
No, did he do an ad for Mitt?
He did an ad for Mitt because Mitt Romney will bring us to the brink of the zombie apocalypse. I'll put that in the show notes for anyone who hasn't seen it yet.
For anyone who hasn't, indeed. All right, should we get back on track, please, ladies and gentlemen? This is season 3, episode 3. You missed season 1 and season 3, episode 1 and 2.
Did I miss a season?
You missed two whole episodes, Simon. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice to have you.
Three.
But you're back, and you've
It's
now
like 24. What was it? 24 hours, whatever that horror film. You know, Danny Boyle. You know, they all. You know,
24 hours. 28 days later.
28 days later. It's been like that, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, that
What? Just this this apocalypse of this wasteland of kind of worth and humour that's been missing
definitely,
from the show.
Your absence. I mean, what happened was that we basically we would say something, Kaylee would say something, and then we would just stare at the empty chair for five minutes, and people could fill it in for themselves based on what they knew about what you'd said in the past.
That's good. It was a great exercise.
Nice difference to me. That's good.
In today's episode of the show, we interview the star of the new high financial thriller Arbitrage, Richard Gere's heir. Actually, we're not going to interview Richard Gere's heir, but we will be running the ruler over its Oscar chances. We do have a special guest interview on the show today. It's Kiwi movie icon Gaylene Preston talking about the new documentary Tātarakihi, The Children of Parihaka. We also look at the Māori cannibal splatter fest Fresh Meat and the Aussie comedy Mental, which reunites Toni Collette and PJ Hogan 18 years after Muriel's wedding. And, I was just about to say, we were going to discuss the merger of the Mouse and the Jedi, Disney buying Lucasfilm, but we've covered that one off, so tick that box. So let's go to the mailbag. What have been people been tweeting at us, Kaylee?
We've got some lovely compliments this week on the show. Wood of Kings on Twitter said, Cinematic Cast, just started listening to your podcasts. You make me happy in my brain tank.
Brain tank.
That's very nice because that's Nick Ward, the screenwriter of Lovebirds and Stickmen and various other things. So somebody who knows of which he speaks.
And he has a great profile picture as well. So that helps. Rudy Six. Two-word review for The Untouchables is pure feelings. Laugh, love, tears. Awesome.
Yes.
Aww. Yeah. No, well done. Well done, Rudy.
Yes.
You're a bit reserved on that, Dan.
Yeah, I'm holding back. I'm holding back on that one. But then we did this last week, didn't we?
Did you review it last week?
Yes, we did.
I need to know.
We did.
What was your two words, Dan?
I can't remember.
Just download. To do with bromance.
Bromance?
Yeah, we both tried to do something.
You didn't think it was too sweet, did you, Dan?
I
can tell you did.
Yeah. Basically, well, it wasn't so much the sweetness of it as the sort of kitschy. It was just. It was all just too. Too much.
That's too cynical. It's a lovely piece of escapism. I loved it.
Well, but as I said now, this is a spoiler alert for people who haven't seen the film yet. But as I was mentioning to the team outside, the final scene. It's building up to this beautiful climax. We all know exactly what's going to happen because they're driving north to the sea, to the town where the mysterious woman lives. And yet our quadriplegic hero doesn't have any clue what's going on. Why are we driving north? He doesn't ask. Why are we going to the town where my mysterious girlfriend lives? He doesn't ask. He sits in the hotel in the town where his mysterious girlfriend lives and doesn't think... I wonder, maybe she'll be turning up. Maybe that's what this is all about. He just is dim for a millionaire.
Billionaire.
In French. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not the sharpest tool in the toolbox, really.
I think you're being a bit harsh. Wasn't there some sort of trauma before that, though, when they left? Wasn't there some sort of, I can't remember now. There was something that happened that spurred them to actually take off and go. Like there was, things were turning to custard a little bit around the place.
Oh yeah, no, I understand that. I didn't understand why he would somehow not work out in advance, which
maybe
I did,
he did.
What was going
maybe
on?
Maybe he did. He just was in denial.
He was playing along.
Yeah, maybe
he was playing along for the sake of the movie.
Yeah,
good
wanted to know.
Stuff.
My reasoning, I was like, well, maybe he was napping in the car.
When
they drove past the sign.
and the hotel that said Hotel de whatever it was.
Yeah.
You've just got to let these things run their course, my friend. You just take it up for what it is.
That is the big question, isn't it? Is that if you're worrying about plot holes, then something else has gone wrong with the film. That would be right. And that one was definitely one where I just went, oh, come on.
You see, you're just too tough. It's just
One of us has to be.
I know. But I think,
somebody's got to have some rigor. Anything else in Twitterville?
I'm sure I can go back and find something that you just gushed over, which was kind of full of flaws.
Yeah, of course. There you go. We're all just arguing for our taste.
I know. And I'm right.
Well, the Mirka enjoyed The Untouchables because their two-word review is fine bromance. So there you go.
And box office-wise, the market has spoken, hasn't it? When was the last time a foreign language film kicked in like that at number 4, I think, in the opening week?
Yeah, true.
You know, there's
true.
An expectation for it. Yeah. A bit of excitement.
I didn't say it was awful or horrible. I just there are better films. And actually, we discussed last week that unfortunately the better films that were perhaps some of them were in the festival, there's no release dates for them, and it looks like we're not going to see them here. Whereas the Untouchables has sort of got the space
films,
to itself.
But films don't get released post festival. What are you talking about? They're exclusive. They're always about the festival, and those films that play there never really that often coming out afterwards, are they?
Shush, you troublemaker. Oh. What else is happening in Facebook land?
What is happening in Facebook land? Is there something special happening?
I don't know. I wonder whether we should move on and start talking about Richard Gere's hair.
I thought that was a good progression to the top five.
Oh yeah. Right, yes.
Give us the top five.
Okay. Yes. sitting at.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. I've missed you.
Sitting at number five, down from three, is Pitch Perfect. Opening at number four is The Untouchables. Opening at three is Argo.
That's good news.
Yeah.
Yes. Sitting pretty at, or not so pretty, at number two is Paranormal Activity. And still sticking in there after 3 weeks at number one, Taken 2.
Not
staggering, actually.
It is, why aren't people listening to our podcast?
Well, clearly. Well, maybe they're listening to our podcast and going, nothing could be that bad, and going to prove it.
But isn't it funny, because it didn't drop off like the big drop that you'd expect in week two?
No, but week two to three dropped 50%, which is okay.
That's solid, but yeah. But
I think that what was interesting, it's the first time I'd looked at the totals for a long time, and last week to this week, The box office as a whole reported across New Zealand dropped 50%, which just goes to show how important big films opening are.
Yes.
You know, the big tent poles, they really do drive...
they create the momentum, yeah. And it, you exactly. know, every second week there should be a big one.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. And not this week. Not a little bit quiet on this week's front. So should we talk about Richard Gere?
Let's
do it now.
So what's up with his hair? Yes, you seem word. Pretty... Here, envy.
I've got to have the right program open. It's no good pushing the space bar if you don't have the right program open.
Jimmy, it's me.
You want to tell me what this is?
You don't ask.
The car rolled on multiple impacts. She was here, and her feet were down here.
So who kicked out the door?
The situation would be manslaughter.
What would you advise such a person to do?
There's about 50 things that person wouldn't have thought of.
Fingerprints, DNA, cell phone records.
That person were closing a merger with a large bank. Any arrest could derail the transaction.
All right, that's basically the entire plot of Arbitrage in 30 seconds worth of trailer. Who do we assign this one to? Kaylee. Okay,
yes.
Hands up at the back.
So yes, Arbitrage, starring Richard Gere, Susan Sarandon, and Tim Roth. And I'm just going to read the synopsis because it's so good, in my trailer voice. Richard Gere, Susan Sarandon, and Tim Roth star in this business thriller following a fraudulent New York hedge fund magnate whose life brinks on collapse after an unforeseen incident threatens to expose him. Arbitrage, buying low and selling high, depends on a person's ability to determine the true value of any given market. Dan, what is the true value of this film?
Garbage is what it is, isn't it? It's this was such a disappointment.
It was,
after Margin Call last year or earlier on this year came out of left field, low budget, very tight script, very much about the world of high finance and corporate sort of brinksmanship and living on the edge and just a really perfectly constructed little film. And I think that this is sort of riding on the coattails a little bit, trying to sort of capture the same milieu, but it's really lazy stuff. Lots and lots of cliches. Richard Gere has been touted as this is his Oscar contender. You know, back in action. I mean, he does do some acting, which he doesn't always do. You know,
yeah,
let's be honest.
I think you pointed out that there was that like. There's one scene.
Yeah. There's exactly. That was scene. It. Yeah. When it finished, it was like, yeah, that's the Oscar scene. That's the one that.
There's a minute. There's a minute of Oscar worthiness. That's it.
There's a real problem in that the character, this central character, has absolutely no redeeming features or qualities whatsoever. Right? Like he's basically a greedy, single-minded, money-grabbing corporate capitalist whore.
With great
and
hair.
With great hair, having said that. That is his redeeming quality, actually. I was watching it and thinking, oh, maybe I'll grow mine. It's a similar tint.
Yeah.
But... You know, he's just such an awful person, and then he does a whole lot of awful things, and then he doubles down on the awfulness, and somehow we're supposed to have some kind of sympathy, you know. But actually, the whole film is about people who are living on privilege, living privileged lives. This is the 1%, and they seem to have no conception of the damage that they do to the little people, and yet the film doesn't really make a strong enough judgment about that behavior, about those attitudes. So yeah, I had a real problem with it, you know, to be honest. And what was Tim Roth doing playing the cop, the investigating cop? And it's like the director basically just didn't have the guts to tell him to pull his head in. You know, a very strange performance from Tim Roth. And there's also a cameo performance by the editor of Vanity Fair, again kind of random.
Ugh.
Random moment. Have you got anything to add there while I think of my two words?
No, just to say that also his mistress just was an awful person as well. Like, there wasn't really anybody.
Yeah, yeah, likeable. Exactly. There's a spoiler here to say that she carks it fairly early in the film, right? But you don't miss her, do you really?
No. No, and it's like especially I think the female characters are just written so poorly. It's like we talked about Killing Them Softly last week, about, you know, a film without females in it, and kind of like, this is what happens when there's no women to reel all these like men in, and they're out of control, and this is... Ooh.
Yeah, Susan Sarandon. And Susan Sarandon's been great, hasn't she? Like, she knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
And yet this is a film where she's playing a complete cliche. It's just so disappointing. And good people are in it, but
yeah,
this is
performances are just sort of like dialed in.
Yeah, like, exactly. Phoned in performances. Dialed in's fine. And but the real problem is the script, and like they're given nothing to work with, and structurally it's all wrong. They're calling it a thriller, but there's nothing terribly thrilling about it. There's a tiny little race against time moment, but you don't want him to win. You don't want him to succeed. You want him to get his comeuppance somehow, like Richard III or something.
Strangely, though, I can see my parents enjoying this, like renting this and kind of watching it at home with popcorn.
Talking all the way through it with any, like, you know, it's... Sorry, we're dissing this one, aren't we?
We're pretty harsh, but I think my parents would like it.
Okay.
So maybe this is...
I just hope that, from what you're saying, because I haven't seen it yet, but from what you're saying, it doesn't grab the bull by the horns and actually make a statement, which is what's disappointing about it.
I think it thinks it does.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But it actually doesn't pull it off. I think it thinks that it's sort of shining a light on the
Overall, it hasn't reviewed too badly around the traps. You know, it's sort of...
And it's played at festivals around the world, and it's definitely been getting a real push in terms of award contention. Like, it was launched with that...
Yeah.
With that in mind, but it just seems to be not...
Yeah, I just didn't see it.
No, mm-hmm. That's exactly right. We, you know, the film finished and we looked at each other and went, really?
I better check it out now and just make sure you guys are onto it.
Yeah, well, that's right, because, you know, you're always right.
That's right.
Yes, but the pizza was good. That was enjoyable.
Yeah. What, you had pizza during the film?
Yeah.
Oh.
We had a little movie night in.
Yeah.
Which was nice.
I'm watching Ghostbusters tonight with my daughter for Halloween.
Wow. Speaking of,
that was Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park was great. I'd never seen Jurassic Park before, and as part of the Steven Spielberg sort of retrospective that Event Cinemas are running around the country, there was a screening of Jurassic Park at the Embassy Theatre in Wellington, very, very well attended, big crowd out, lots of people getting all nostalgic about a film that they saw when they were kids. For me, it was the first time. Never had
really.
It passed me by the first time around, and I tell you what, I was sort of half expecting it to be pretty cheesy, but I enjoyed it a lot. Actually, Sam Neill's fantastic.
Yeah, you see,
holds up, mate.
I remember it, like when I watched it, and I just went, yeah, you know. It's dinosaurs.
Yeah, but I'm right.
I remember being really scared. I watched it at my friend's... I remember, because today's Halloween, Wednesday. I watched it at my friend's Halloween party when I was like 6. And I was dressed up as like this fairy princess. My mom made the costume. And I was so freaked out by Jurassic Park. And it was playing on this like little tiny TV in the corner. And I was like, ugh.
Yeah, I've got to say, on the whole, you know, Spielberg films don't really kind of click for me. I don't know what it is, but they just don't sort of grab you enough. They're
so
too
you
cheesy
won't be,
on the whole.
So you won't be interested in the fact that Jaws is playing tonight at the Roxy Cinema in town, and on December the 7th at the Embassy. And actually, if people all over the country should check their event cinemas.
I have to say that
playing
Jaws was something that would probably appeal to me, but things like Jurassic Park and wouldn't really do it for me. I'm afraid. I'd rather go and see Ghostbusters or something like that than that.
Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of the ones in this retrospective. I noticed that things like Armistead and Hook aren't in there, because he's been a busy boy, hasn't he?
But he always gets too sugary, I reckon.
Okay.
He always sort of
flies it in on. The new year, we'll find out all about Abraham Lincoln.
See how
that goes. We should wrap this up because we've got to move on. What's our two words?
My two words for arbitrage is garage sale.
All right, well done. Good. Mine is deathly boring, unfortunately, for Richard Gere's career.
From the people who didn't bring you the Whale Rider. Or once were warriors. Comes an emotional feast. Touching. Tender.
Like it.
Johnny.
And tasteful.
Please tell me what this is doing in our fridge.
It's rude to sit at a Maori table and not eat.
Inspired by the likes of Shaun of the Dead and other comedy horrors, this is Wellington's own latest cannibal gore fest. Latest.
Not in Guatemala
first,
now.
First. Exactly. Tamworth Morrison plays the patriarch of a middle-class Māori family in somewhere like Newlands or somewhere, aren't they? They're up in the burbs. And their house is invaded by a gang of crims on the run from the cops, having sprung their boss out of a jail van.
Which is That's quite a cool little
it's a good opening.
Scene at the
it's,
start.
It's a good opening. It gets you underway.
Gets you going, yeah.
And so they take over this house, and unfortunately they've chosen the wrong house to invade, because these guys are cannibals, and they Tamworth Morrison's character has sort of resurrected an ancient religion which involves imbibing the life force of various people, murdering them, chopping them up in the downstairs butchery, and then eating them. And it's kind of handy because his wife is a popular TV chef.
Yeah.
And so she's
success,
got all the tools.
Isn't she?
Yeah, she's the success
of
the family.
He's not even in print. He's an academic who can't get printed.
Exactly. And so we're starting to see the dynamic of that relationship. It's kind of self-consciously wacky. The characters are all really sort of broadly drawn. It makes a really big splash of the digital blood and the real blood and all of that sort of stuff. Question for you guys, have we both seen it? All three of us seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Both seen it. Great. Okay, so Kaylee, what did you think first of all?
I was entertained. I was surprised, actually. It came off a little bit better than I thought it would. I was definitely entertained. I felt like there was a lot going on. It started out with kind of these Rodriguez and Tarantino references.
Lots of Tarantino in the music as well, Ian.
Yeah, yep. And then sort of spooled into this kind of early Peter Jackson and a few other things. So it is dipping into kind of a few directors and giving nods to a few different genres. Digital effects weren't great. There were some issues there, but I was entertained and it was kind of funny. And I think for what it was going for, it achieved it. Like that, it fits in with, I find it really interesting, the New Zealand kind of horror pulp, like
that
history.
genre
yeah
stuff.
That history here is quite rich and quite interesting, so I think it's a really good entry into that kind of mecca.
It's a tradition, isn't it?
Yeah New Zealand knows how to make really, really silly horror films, and I think this is another one that goes right on there.
Si, you're not so enthusiastic, are
yeah
you?
I've got to say that's what I was hoping it would do, but for me it fell short of the mark, and I wanted it to work. You know, I really wanted it to kind of work. But for me, I just thought, this is kind of just, I don't know. To compare it to things like Shaun of the Dead is just so far removed. I mean, it's not in that ballpark at all. And I mean, it does have its moments. Like, you know, the opening sequence I think is great. And there's some neat little winks to other films, like you say, in that opening sequence. It was very Tarantino. And I thought the guy who played the sort of PC European who wanted to be, you know, Maori. You know,
the neighbor.
I mean, who hasn't had one of those, you know,
the bone carving
yeah, and all that sort of stuff? And I thought, that kind of hooked into that quite nicely, and he was quite funny. But
I felt that his last scene before he, you know, goes on, I felt that if that comedy and that, like, kind of smart dialogue was carried through the whole film, yes, it would be much better.
Yeah.
Like, that was one of the best scenes.
Yeah, it was. And I think maybe that's what, for me, didn't kind of grab me, is that there wasn't that kind of wacky humor in it in places as well, which, you know, I think that's what often we've done well in the past, is we've got that splattered gore, but we've also got this kind of wacky sense of humor in it as well. And I just felt that was, it didn't kind of push those buttons. Yeah. But, I don't know what problem with it is. I mean, so much effort goes into these things, and you sort of look at it and then go, well, it's kind of felt short.
It's the first feature film by Gibson Group, who are well known in Wellington for television production and also very efficiently budgeted, shall we say, television production. And I think that to take those skills and to get them up on the big screen, interesting that, you know, all of the prosthetic effects and the blood and all the rest of it, not, you know, look at the credits at the end and there's no mention of Weta anywhere,
no,
you know,
just there might be in
there's which is a good sign for the industry in Wellington, and that, you know, there's a whole lot of other people outside of that ecosystem that can do that sort of work, which is really good.
Yeah, but it did have a made for TV or TV look and feel to it.
Yeah, I think that's a wee problem. And my other problem was pace, really. I think that if it had just been tighter, you know, there were just patches where it sort of flagged and you were sort of wandering around, your attention was sort of wasn't entirely focused. If you think about the people who are doing this stuff really well, like Shaun of the Dead, the kind of films that Edgar Wright is directing, and you think about how tightly edited they are, they're percussive, they're punchy, and there's sort of no time left. You know, you've got no time for your attention to wander because something else is happening again and again and again. And that's, I think, the problem that this film has. It's got its moments, but there's too much going on between, or not enough going on between them. So let's wrap this up and start with two words, Simon.
Dead meat.
Oh, that's a big call. Yep. Okay. But you've seen the box office, haven't you?
Too, doesn't it? Sounds good too, like, you know,
yeah.
You're dead meat. You're dead meat.
Yeah. Mine, because I felt it was quite blokey. My two words is sausage roll.
Oh, sausage, you guys roll. Are on fire today.
Yeah, well, anything to do with food, and we're there, eh?
Yeah,
you
know? Easy foods.
Marinated.
Okay, on the subject of food, then I would say bloodless pudding.
Bloodless pudding,
for mine. So, a little bit, a wee bit of disappointment there.
Could
dead
have done
meat.
With some
interesting
kiwi
to see
in
how
marinade.
Long. Yeah.
I think I need a breath mint.
Oof. Interesting to see how long it actually lasts in cinemas and whether, you know, how quickly it ends up going into home
and
video.
And I would love to know, like, you know, is this really something which is DVD, VOD, all that sort of thing down the line, and that's where actually the return is in this for these guys? Because I kind of suspect that's where it is.
I would say so. I would say that it's probably pre-sold to a few markets as well on that basis. Time for some news.
Thank you. It's Sir Peter Jackson's 51st birthday today, and we at Cinematica wonder, what do you get the filmmaker who has everything?
C-Tune.
Yeah, well, he's got it, isn't he?
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Miramar and C-Tune. Pretty much that. Pretty much everything east of the airport.
Downstage, Opera House,
a hungy.
Saint yeah, he's got bats, isn't he? He's got bats already. Yeah.
I think he should have a hungy at the back of Park Road. There you go. That's a good idea for a birthday party, isn't it?
All right. Well, let's just hope that he invites us.
When was the last time you had a hungy? When were you last at a hungy?
On me?
There's a hungy cart at the Wellington Night Market.
That's not the same.
No, I have never. Never.
Have you never had a hungy?
Maybe
we
should have
them as kids. They're great.
A Cinematica hungy for Christmas.
We should do it.
For Christmas.
We could do a little tweet up.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'll leave that with you to organise.
Well, I won't be here, so you have to organise.
Darren.
Yeah, it's not as...
So you're good at organising things.
But we got to dig a big hole and you got to catch all this. You got to go pig hunting and, you just...
I'm not enthusiastic about that now. No, not so much.
I don't mind.
Okay, what's next?
Maybe we'll just go to the night market. And rumours abound of a sequel to The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Woo! Fox Searchlight have commissioned a treatment from original screenwriter Ol Parker, and the cast are keen to work together again. The first film made $130 million worldwide on a budget of only $10 million.
Yeah, so it just goes to show, you know, you can the franchises are everywhere if you just scratch
and
them
why wouldn't
enough.
You something for the older audience, which is underserviced, why wouldn't you
well
rock
and
you
do and you need to sort of put your foot down because those guys aren't getting any younger, are they?
I mean, hey, you look at Hitchcock, you know, you've got old
Anthony Hopkins
and Helen Mirren, you know what I mean, I just saw that one. Okay, that'll do.
Have you seen it or have you just
taken it on that.
All right.
The trailer is great. The trailer is fantastic.
Brilliant.
It'll be fantastic. But it's funny because I saw this article recently about box office in the US and how it was struggling, really. And they were saying, though, that, you know, one of the big factors was this competition with TV, you know, Game of Thrones, Mad Men, I don't know, all these quality, you know, strong TV shows. And you go, yeah, that's true. But surely the answer to that then is to make more clever, smart stuff that appeals to a kind of
to an audience that used to watch television on a Sunday night.
Yeah, just
and
don't
now doesn't have anything to go to.
Don't keep going back to formula, you know. And that's I don't know. It just seems to me that you look at something like Marigold, and that is outside that sort of normal formula role that the Hollywood sort of producers, and it worked a treat. Knock more out. Keep going.
Indeed. Yep. That's I think every cinema owner in the world would love another one of those. I don't think that. I remember seeing the trailer for that a year ago because the trailer was running for a long time before the film came out, and I remember watching that trailer and thinking that is a license to print money. I knew it straight away.
But it's for the indies.
Yeah. True.
It's not for the multiplex. You know, I mean, they do all right, but it's not their bread and butter.
Right. In other news,
Kaylee needs a nap.
You heard it here first.
We are still looking for pledges to send me to Sundance in 2013. So get pledging, people.
Yep, Si and I are going to pledge because we can't wait to get rid of it. Send her to Sundance.
Only it's like as you know, $10 and up, and you will get prizes and admiration, and you know, might even come to your house and bake cupcakes.
Yeah, look, we're looking forward to all of that, and very much looking forward to having a Cinematica cast correspondent at Sundance to find out what it's like, because you know, I've never been. I don't know what it's like. It'll be cold, is
my
understanding.
Cold.
Yeah,
and I want to be there, so help me out, people. I need your help. I need your votes.
There's a new New Zealand documentary that is opening in Auckland this weekend and making its way around the country as time goes on. It played at the New Zealand Film Festival. It's one of 10 documentaries from New Zealand that played at the festival this year. This is Tātarakihi, The Children of Parihaka, and it's a fascinating insight into New Zealand history and Māori history and Māori attitudes to history as well. It's executive produced by New Zealand film icon Gaylene Preston, and I spoke to her earlier on this week, and my first question was how she got involved.
I've been going to Parihaka to and fro in a little and often since 1981. When I went to the centenary there that they had of the centenary of the siege. So that happened in 1881. So, and I went back with Eruera Nia in 1981 with they had a works trust hui there. And at that time I had the Mr. Wrong Jag, and and we filled that full of video gear, which was, you know, in those days, really old video gear was really big. And we took it to Parihaka and set it up in Te Pai Pai and did a week-long video workshop to train people how to tell their own stories. So that's been my involvement with Parihaka since then. And when Pāra Joseph arrived in the district, it was really great because he had he was the one who had the real mission to want to record oral histories and really get the story of Parihaka out to the world in film form. And so it was really great because then I had someone to work with, because I I didn't feel that it was my place to be leading a project like that.
And this is a story, the story of Pāre Haka, that has been told in other forms previously. There's a few books that I've read, and listeners with access to sort of memories of New Zealand pop history will remember a Tim Finn song with Herbs that was a big hit about 20 years ago. And is this the first time that that film has looked at this story?
No, I think there's been other work that has, there's been work that's gone to Māori television, but I think, I'm pretty sure that I know this is the first cinema piece.
And what's the approach that that Paura and Janine Martin have taken on this film? What's the method that they're using to tell this story?
Well, it was one of those things that Well, it was the perfect way to do it, really. It was one of those films that grew. Like a lot of good documentaries, you know, it's a case of something's happening, pick up your camera and go for it.
Mm-hmm.
So Paura and I had been doing oral histories of some kaumātua up there at Pāre Haka. And round about that time, Mātau Wharehoka said that the Kura Kaupapa were going down to Dunedin to visit the caves, and they were going to be calling in on all the places where the ancestors had been incarcerated. So it was, and she said, come too. So it was a case of grabbing cameras and just getting on the bus. So Paura got on the bus, and then I was supposed to be on the bus, but I had to go to Sydney for a Home by Christmas screening. So that's how long ago it was. Home by Christmas was just being completed. And so I rode side saddle and got tapes to them and things like that. And so when they came off the bus, all the tapes came my way, and Tracy Egerton had been working on a short film that my assistant Michelle Saville was making. So yep. Tracy was kind of in the house. So she had a great interest in te reo. So Tracy got the job of logging all the tapes. And that's how the team was made. And from there on, we just started. Paura raised the money from TSB Trust, which allowed Tracy to take the material up to New Plymouth and work with Janine and him. And they did a rough cut, and then they bought the film down here and lived here in my house in Mount Victoria. And we started to add all the archival backstory to the story of the kids on the bus. So the film kept telling us what it wanted. There was a point there where Paura went to Mata and Ngāpere and the people and asked if they wanted. Did they want an educational video? Because he'd made a really successful one called Hiding Behind the Green Screen. Did they want an educational video, or did they want a film that went out into the world? And they said they wanted a film that went out into the world. So every time they said something like that, we'd have to roll our sleeves up, raise some more money, and do the next bit.
And how hard has that been when you say take it out to the world? That's an extremely challenging undertaking.
Yeah, it is. And every time the film grew, it had to raise more money. At a certain point, we had a rough cut. and I decided to see if Bill Gosden would give us some notes. So Bill came and looked at the film, and he said he would select it for the film festival. So then that meant, well, we are going to cinema. So again, we had to raise more money. And, you know, it's kind of like the world challenged us. And we felt that we were really the servants of the kaupapa. So we just do whatever came next. So it wasn't a case of us sitting around having a dream. Although, you know, I think that Mata and Paura are the dream makers in terms of this film, in terms of what they wanted it to do. Because, you know, it presents a lot of technical difficulties when what you've done is you've got on the bus. Because, you know, some of the shooting that's actually in the film was shot by 11-year-olds.
Right.
You know, it wasn't a shortage of footage that we had. And I mean, actually, if anything has shown to me clearly what good documentary is based on, it's totally to do with access. You know, because if you've got good access, you might have shots that are a bit grumpy, but it's amazing how once you start cutting things together and it all starts to get a bit beautiful. And once we gave it to Park Road Post, it got even more beautiful. And, of course, the archive footage had terrific graphics. And we had a wonderful graphics person who did extra work on that. So, I mean, it's really interesting. It took ages. It took 3 years. But it's really interesting to me how it is to do with access. If you're making a documentary, that's what it's about.
For listeners who are unfamiliar with Parehaka, or perhaps only familiar with it as a sort of name from the past, is the film a good introduction for them to the story?
I think it's a brilliant introduction in that I think that what the film really is, to me, it's about how a community chooses to remember. It's not just what is remembered, it's how it's remembered. And it is a fantastic insight into the important ways that Māori approach remembering. And it's communal remembering.
And that was Gaylene Preston talking to me earlier on this week. And that was just one part of an extended interview, which we will make available as a Cinematica extra a little bit later on in the week. She was talking about Tātarakihi, The Children of Parehaka, which is a documentary that's playing around the country from this weekend. And the rest of the interview, we sort of extend off into talking about her career and getting a little bit of insight into how she works and the kind of work that she likes to do. It was a really interesting interview.
Well, isn't it great to see, you know, content like that coming out, which is about, you know, New Zealand history, New Zealand events from a New Zealand point of view and all those sorts of things, which is what, you know, that's what the funding should be for. I mean, if you could move that over into more sort of films that have got, you know, that are dramatic, that are more, you know, like commercial, but still have those sorts of things, you know, in them, I think it would be even better.
That's right. But the constant sort of struggle that she has to get funding for her work, and how hard they found it to get funding for this. She was saying, she says a little bit later on in the interview, how she had to go to Park Road Post to sort of plead with them about the bill, and they just said, oh look, we'll just have to put it on our sponsorship tab. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a tough road telling New Zealand stories in New Zealand, and you know, which is in some ways we should be celebrating films like Fresh Meat for even getting on screen. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of patronizing to say it, but we know what a struggle it is, and you know, it's these things are tough. I hope that people get to download the full interview with Gaylene, because she's a great speaker and she's got a wonderful, wonderful way with words. But back to the main body of the show, the business at hand.
You agree to watch him and talk to us. You're out of here like nothing ever happened. Back to your mom. Back to your boy. Nobody dies. Nobody gets hurt. We do this together. But you have to be sure.
We need to talk. Now.
You make a mistake, I'm dead.
You lose your love. Then you're back like nothing ever happened. Don't leave Belfast. We're not done yet.
All right, Shadow Dancer. This is a thriller set in the early 1990s in Northern Ireland, when the peace process is in the process of being negotiated, and a British intelligence agent, played by Clive Owen, he identifies a young woman who's part of an IRA family who's been involved in terrorist activities, but he senses that she's ready to be turned to away from the darkness, and so he brings her in and basically promises that everything, you know, that he'll keep her safe as long as and keep her out of prison as long as she informs on her family and the rest of the rebellious IRA gang that she works with. And it's very tense. There's a lot of basically things go wrong from the very beginning. He's being double-crossed by his colleagues in the British intelligence services. She doesn't know who to trust on her side, and it has a sort of feel of television about it in terms of the look and feel about it. It's a BBC Productions film, so you know a lot of the money would have been come from television. The director, James Marsh, is probably best known for his documentary work. He directed Project NIMH, which I think we loved, yeah, and also Man on Wire, the Academy Award winning documentary. So he's got good form, in, but he's also made some drama for television, the Red Riding trilogy, about based on the Yorkshire Ripper story. So this is a film that it'd be really easy for it to sort of end up under the radar, you know, with so many big names coming out, with so many big films coming out. This is a film that's being quietly distributed and slipped into independent cinemas, and I get the feeling that people who like a really solid, intelligent, well-made British thriller, the kind of which that we just don't get very much on television screens anymore, I think they'll get a bit of a kick out of it, actually. Clive Owen, I have reservations about, because you know there's just something wooden about him, something dead behind the eyes with Clive Owen, but you know, he can get films made. He's a movie star, but the big star is Andrea Riseborough, the woman playing the lead actress playing Colette McVeigh, the tout, and I didn't recognise her from Brighton Rock. Did you guys see the film Brighton Rock? Yeah. Well, she was the girlfriend in that, and she's a heck of an actor, actually, and yeah, really, really good. So Shadow Dancer, it's got a really naff title. Shadow Dancer. It sounds like an 80s pop record.
I'm thinking Tina Turner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's another reason why people, it might not sort of be on people's radar. But, you know, I think that this is one that, you know, if you stumble across it, it's worth taking a look at.
You got the two words?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me about my two words. Yeah, maybe. Well, I'll tell you what, actually, I could use the two-word review, Private Dancer, because I actually was the only one in the cinema who watched it on Saturday morning, so which is a little bit depressing. I mean, admittedly, it was like 12 o'clock on Saturday, and you know, it's a tough time to get people out to the movies if it's not a kid's film. But, yeah, a bit disappointing that I was, in fact, the only person sitting in row C of the cinema that I watched it in. So, yeah, we'll call that one Private Dancer and move on.
I'm autistic. Dad, I'm
sick. Are you moist?
This wouldn't be happening to me if I had a family of boys.
Boys have breakdowns, Dad.
Not Australian boys. They're too busy playing football.
Who's that woman?
I forget her name.
G'day.
Sharon Thornbender.
But you are to do everything she tells you.
Verbal Isley.
You share with Jane.
I am Jane.
In all my life, I have never witnessed a sorrier display.
There's a hint of my review coming up, my two-word review coming up. But, Simon, you're our Australian mental health correspondent for today.
Yes, yes.
We dragged you to the cinema so you could watch it.
Yes, and it's the old team getting back after a wee while after Muriel's wedding, and I thought, you know, I have nothing but fond memories of Muriel's wedding.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
So Toni Collette plays this kind of oddball character who is kind of roped into looking after this pack of female children after the mother, played by Rebecca
Gibney yeah.
Kind of goes AWOL. She ends up in a place for where she's had a breakdown of sorts, even though it's a very kind of
They call it a loony bin, but it looked very
it's very kind of like, it's more like just taking a time out. It's the sense you get from it. Mm. But and she comes along and she provides and of course the husband, played by
Anthony LaPaglia,
who's really good. I mean, he's funny and he's quite, you know,
he's a really underrated actor.
He is,
I reckon. Yeah.
And he's really good in this role. And he plays this mayor of the local town who is just obsessed about the mayor and is having about being a mayor and is having affairs.
And did you notice that it's the same town from Muriel's wedding? Dolphin Heads.
Yeah. There you go, well spotted. Yeah, so and so these kids are all sort of neglected, I think is the way to describe it. They're unloved and even though the mother, I think, is sort of, you know, looking after them best she can, and they all believe that they've kind of got these kind of mental illnesses and there's things wrong with them and so on, when really all they need is a bit of confidence and a bit of attention
to be paid to them. Mm. Yeah.
And that's what Toni Collette's character sort of initially provides. As the film progresses, though, it turns into something else and becomes more about Toni Collette's character and her past and things that have had an have gone wrong for her, I guess.
She trying to repair?
Yeah, what's she trying to repair? And old Liev Schreiber's in there, and he plays, there's a bit of a spoiler alert there, but his character is quite central to it as well.
Yeah, he's a shark hunter, isn't
he? He is a shark hunter.
And I tell you what. The best Australian accent by an American that
he
I
knocks
have
it out of the park.
Ever heard.
Yeah, yeah, he's
just
very good.
Fantastic.
And I really liked him on the screen. Like when he was in the film, I thought he was really good. And he brought a suffering that his character was meant to have had, and he did it really well. And yet he was still kind of that scene where he kind of stops the a young chap from seducing the young lady in it. You know, like, it's very well done,
with the cattle prod.
Yeah, with the cattle prod, you know, and that sort of stuff. I liked it. And it is a film, though, that promises quite a lot and yet misses the mark. And not all the time, but some of the time, and it drags on. And the funny thing is, like, it must have had about four or five different endings. Like, it actually hits a point, and then you could have ended it, and then it hits another point, and it could have ended it. And it is a little bit confusing, I think, the last sort of 20-odd minutes. It kind of gets a bit out of whack, and you're thinking, gee, you know, where's it all going? Yeah, whilst it was something that I was actually quite excited about, I thought, you know, this is a great pairing and something that you know, could be very funny and very family and a really kind of neat film. It fails to deliver, ultimately, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. Kaylee, you haven't seen it? Oh, darn.
Sorry.
I thought I saw a tweet from you saying you're at it, but it must have been fresh meat that I saw, so a little bit of confusion.
No,
there.
Sorry, I'm falling a bit behind.
Pay attention, because you know you won't get quality Australian entertainment like Mental at Sundance, let me tell you.
Yeah. I mean, you look at it compared to say Sapphires, and Sapphires knows what it's about and it's tight and it kind of does it very well. And that's probably one of the better Australian films in a while. And then you look at something like this and you think, well, this could do the same thing quite comfortably. But for some reason
it's a ruddy shambles.
Yeah, they just make a mess of it.
And as you said before, there's there are good elements to all of it. Like, the casting is fantastic. Yeah, if you look at the names, the names of the people who are in it, the kids are really good.
It's the way that it's written.
Exactly. Liev Schreiber has some great moments. LaPaglia has some great moments. They've all got scenes. Rebecca Gibney's got a scene where she's just fantastic.
There's
Carrie Fox. New Zealander Carrie Fox
is in it. Some very funny moments in it where you chuckle away and all the rest of it. You know,
it's just a mess, isn't it? And I've thought about this film and tried to work it out more than I have some others recently, and I don't know if it deserves the sort of attention that I've been giving it, but I'm trying to work it out. Like, it's shambolic, it's a mess, it's a bit of a fiasco at times, but I think that might be the point. I think that you know, it's about the messy state of people's lives, the confusion, being lived to its fullest, blah, blah, blah.
And I like the whole idea of actually, well, you know, these people that are really anal about keeping their lawn clean or, you know, like the driveway clean and the furniture pristine, you know, they're actually the ones with an illness, not the people that sort of enjoy life, mess about and make a mess and express themselves. And I really liked that message. I thought that was a good one. But then it didn't kind of... It sort of dwelt on it and then moved on.
It sells itself out as well.
I found it a frustrating film because it sort of promised so much and it does have all these good elements to it, but it just doesn't get wrapped up well enough.
And do you have two words for us talking of wrap ups?
I was going to say mental illness, but
it sounds like hot mess should be someone's two word review.
Yeah, well, you
shark attack.
Mine are badly deranged. Because, you know, it just doesn't, it's like it aims for a million things at once and misses 99% of them, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
All right, that is our show for this week. Next week, it's Sharks at the Supermarket in 3D thriller Bait. Tyler Perry, who is he, you may ask? He swaps his Madea dress for a sidearm in Alex Cross. And Helen Hunt teaches a profoundly disabled man the language of love in The Sessions. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. And if you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in whichever your favourite podcast software is, so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. You don't have to be reminded by us. If you feel like it, leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Ratings, reviews, they help push us up the ratings ladder. And you can contact us with your feedback and your two-word reviews. Kaylee, how do people do that?
You can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at www.facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, and as usual on our website, our beautiful website at www.cinematica.com.
And at that website is where you can also find links to the various things that we've been talking about. So go to the episode page and you'll find other things to divert you and entertain you. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music. Nothing from any of this week's films, because there wasn't actually much in the way of music. But while I was looking for that Star Wars gag at the beginning, I found... this Cliff Edwards, When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio, and I thought, well, we hadn't heard that for a while. So here it is.